I can't think of many consoles that get more consistent praise than the Nintendo GameCube. With its elite controller and fantastic lineup of games, there is certainly a lot to love. If you were to judge the console based purely on its internet reputation, you would come to the quick conclusion that the GameCube must have been a massive success. But in reality, this was not the case. In fact, the GameCube was Nintendo's least successful home console they had ever released at that time. I find this parallel to be extremely interesting. The GameCube was a console that most people didn't care about throughout its life cycle, but nowadays, it's one of the most popular retro consoles around. In today's video, I want to talk about how GameCube was able to have such a dramatic shift in public perception. To do so, we will first look at what caused the console to fail in the first place, and then we will discuss how it's been able to make its massive comeback over 20 years later. When early development began on what would become GameCube, Nintendo was going through a bit of a rough patch. Their most recent console, the Nintendo 64, had failed to meet expectations. Despite being home to some of the most iconic and impactful video games of all time, the N64 only sold around 33 million units. Meanwhile, Nintendo's newest rival Sony was killing it, with their debut PlayStation console outselling the N64 3-1. With cartridges having less storage and being more expensive, many developers chose to team up with PlayStation instead. As Nintendo geared up for their next console, it was clear they could not afford to fall behind again, and would be placing a much larger focus on power this time around. In May of 1999, Nintendo held a press conference to unveil their plans for the next console. As then-chairman of Nintendo Howard Lincoln begins speaking, I think his first words about the system are extremely noteworthy. This next console, codenamed Dolphin, would be, in his own words, extremely powerful, but not expensive. That's a big promise, one that Nintendo would need some help to pull off. Thus came the announcement of three major partnerships that would assist in Dolphin's development and production. The first was a partnership with ArtX, who would be developing the graphics card. ArtX had been founded just 2 years prior in 1997, but Nintendo trusted this new company because their founder, Dr. Wei Yen, played a large role in the N64's development. While the N64 may not have been the most powerful console on the market, it was able to masterfully transition Nintendo into the 3D space. With 3D gaming still being relatively new at this point, having Dr. Yen on board for Dolphin's development was a great sign. The next partnership was huge, with Nintendo announcing they would be working with IBM to produce the CPU. Nintendo was not shy about how much they believed in what they were calling the Gecko processor. This Gecko processor would be a direct extension of IBM's PowerPC architecture and would allow for an unprecedented level of power. They state not once but twice that Dolphin will feature the most powerful CPU ever seen in a home console thanks to this partnership with IBM. Another very bold claim. And finally, Nintendo announced one last partnership, this time with Panasonic to produce the DVD disc drive for Dolphin. Yes, that's right, Nintendo would finally be ditching cartridges. The crowd erupts into cheer as Nintendo fans everywhere let out a sigh of relief that the company was finally going to be getting with the times. That was all we got for our first introduction to Dolphin. This initial press conference certainly gave fans a lot to look forward to, while simultaneously putting a lot of pressure on Nintendo to deliver on their bold promises. I find this press conference incredibly interesting to look back on. It is so uniquely unlike the Nintendo we're used to, partly because of their focus on technical power, but also the way they spoke about their competitors. On multiple occasions, they directly call out the competition. For example, at one point they say, "We are absolutely confident that Dolphin's graphics will equal or exceed anything our friends at Sony can come up with for PlayStation 2. For so much of Nintendo's history, both before and after this, they are always the company doing their own thing. They aren't worried about how their console stacks up to others on the market, instead choosing to focus on innovation, unique features, and new ways of play. But this Dolphin reveal had shown a completely new side of Nintendo. For one of the only times in their storied history, they were attempting to take the competition head on. The next major event for Dolphin was Nintendo Space World 2000, held in August of that year. It was here that the official name was revealed as Nintendo GameCube. We also got to see the console itself for the first time, sporting its fitting cube shape alongside what appeared to be a handle at the top. There weren't many concrete game announcements at this showcase, instead featuring a few tech demos and short clips showing what the console was capable of. Some of these did become full games, such as Luigi's Mansion and Metroid Prime. Others lived in infamy, specifically the Zelda clip, but more on that a bit later. And then there was Super Mario 128, a strange but effective demo meant to show off the processing power of GameCube. Featuring 128 Marios walking around a circular object, the simplistic demo boasted how many character models the GameCube could handle at one time. And you know what? This is the type of thing I expect to see from Nintendo. None of that fancy tech talk with IBM. Let's make a bizarre Mario demo and give it a name that sounds like a sequel to one of our biggest games ever. And then let's be non-committal about whether this is a real game or not for half a decade before before finally admitting it doesn't actually exist in 2007. Now that's the Nintendo we know and love. The final major press event for GameCube prior to its release was E3 2001. It was here that Nintendo gave final details about the console, including its release date, as well as showing off some of the big games coming within the launch window. The GameCube was revealed to be launching on November 5th, 2001 in North America. This date would be just 3 days before Microsoft's Xbox console was set to release. Strangely enough, both consoles would later be delayed by a few weeks, and the GameCube would actually end up launching 3 days after Xbox on November 18, 2001 in North America. On launch day, you could expect to play some high-profile games like Luigi's Mansion, Wave Race Blue Storm, and Star Wars Rogue Squadron 2. The two other major GameCube games shown off were Pikmin and Super Smash Bros. Melee, but both those games were unfortunately going to be missing launch day, instead releasing soon after. Nintendo made a few other notable announcements, such as the required use of memory cards, a first for the company. Another first for the company was the announcement of the WaveBird, a wireless controller for GameCube. Overall, GameCube's presence at E3 2001 was pretty promising. The games were impressive at a technical level, and the console itself seemed to be delivering on everything Nintendo had said it would. The only reason I struggled to call it a perfect reveal is because some of the biggest games people expected to see were missing, such as a new mainline Zelda or Mario game. Meanwhile, the biggest hit game of the showcase was Smash, which would not be available on day one. However, a week after E3, some great news arrived when Nintendo announced the price of GameCube would be $100 less than both the Xbox and PlayStation 2. This meant Nintendo had pulled it off and made good on their bold promise that GameCube would have more or equal power to the competition while being significantly cheaper. All of the signs were pointing to a strong debut for GameCube as we got closer to its release. The GameCube launched in Japan on September 15, 2001, 2 months before any other region. The early reception to the GameCube in Japan was surprisingly weak, with reports saying that Nintendo did not sell out of their initial stock they had sent to the region. Luckily, the North American launch went a lot better. Released in November 2001, there were many more launch titles available day one, and the console was able to sell out of its initial shipment, which was a good sign. Additionally, it was reported that over $100 million worth of GameCube products were sold during its launch week in North America. So things were looking pretty good at first. However, players quickly became fatigued by the launch titles. There just wasn't a ton of great stuff to play. Even some of the higher quality games like Luigi's Mansion or Super Monkey Ball were extremely short, and so a lot of GameCube owners were left sitting around with nothing to do after just a couple days. I think this is significant, as it killed a lot of that initial momentum the console had. Thankfully though, salvation was on the way, as both Pikmin and Super Smash Bros. Melee were released a few weeks later on December 3rd, 2001. Honestly, this is kind of strange looking back now. It's not often you see two premier games for a console come 2 weeks after its launch. Those kinds of games would typically come on launch day or a fair bit after. But regardless, those two big games were out in time for the holidays, which was of course very important. GameCube continued its strong North American sales into the holidays, and Nintendo reportedly anticipated 1.3 million units to be sold by the end of the year. Moving into 2002, it was fair to expect a massive year was coming for GameCube. First off, it was finally released in Europe in May of that year. On top of that, major first-party releases like Metroid Prime, Super Mario Sunshine, and Animal Crossing began hitting the market in North America. Unfortunately though, the console didn't really see the boost in sales you would have expected from such a stacked year. In fact, the sales began to slow significantly. At one point, Nintendo even had to halt production of new GameCube consoles and wait for the current stock to run out. This led us into September 2003, where Nintendo slashed the price of GameCube all the way down to $99.99. The media really hyped up this move, calling it one of, if not the best deal in gaming history. I mean, think about it, most games around this time cost $50, so you could essentially get a brand new system for the price of just two games. Nintendo stated that they hoped the cheap price would draw in new consumers who didn't own a video game console yet, while also enticing someone who already owned a different console to double dip and buy another one. Despite Nintendo's confidence in the move, industry experts at the time felt this price cut wouldn't do much to move the needle. First of all, many retailers had already been discounting the GameCube significantly to begin with. Meanwhile, many felt the $100 price point signified the GameCube may be seeing a shorter than expected lifespan. This could potentially dissuade customers from buying in if they felt like a new Nintendo console was right around the corner. Ultimately, those experts were right. GameCube sales never saw a massive improvement following the price cut, despite a steady output of high quality releases. And in 2005, just 4 years after the GameCube had been released, Nintendo began talking about their next console. The GameCube was officially discontinued in 2007, selling a total of 21.7 million units. This made GameCube the worst selling Nintendo Nintendo home console ever at that time. Following softer than expected sales of the N64 and GameCube, this era no doubt forced Nintendo to do a lot of self-reflection to figure out how this could have happened. So let's do the same here and talk about what exactly caused the GameCube to struggle the way it did. When talking about the GameCube's performance, we first have to address the elephant in the room, the PlayStation 2. The PS2 dominated this console generation in a way that we had never seen before, selling over 150 million units. Meanwhile, none of its competitors even managed over 25 million. We can't sit here and judge the GameCube's success based on the PS2, because that is a losing battle for everybody. But it can't be ignored that having a competitor console on the market demanding that much attention from consumers no doubt played a role in the GameCube's underperformance. However, this is only part of the story. The reality is, Nintendo made a lot of mistakes this generation that pushed gamers to look elsewhere. First off, let's talk about GameCube's discs. As I'm sure many of you know, a GameCube disc is significantly smaller than what we expect from standard CDs or DVDs. Nintendo opted to use mini DVDs, while all of the competitors went with these standard sizes. Nintendo's reasons for doing this were pretty logical. These mini DVDs would be harder to pirate, be cheaper to produce, and allow Nintendo to avoid paying licensing fees. Ultimately though, this decision came with some major downsides, primarily in terms of storage. GameCube discs could only hold up to 1.5 gigabytes. For comparison, PS2 single-layer discs could hold up to 4.7 gigabytes, while dual-layer discs could hold up to 8.5 gigabytes. This lack of disk space meant third-party developers often had to alter the GameCube versions of their games in some way. Specifically, full-motion video and audio were tough to pull off on GameCube. However, this wasn't even the most damaging part of GameCube's small discs. One of the biggest reasons why the PS2 was able to reach levels of success we had never seen from a gaming console before was its compatibility with standard DVDs. This meant the PS2 could be used not only as a gaming console, but also as a DVD player. And it was actually a surprisingly affordable way to get a DVD player compared to others on the market at that time. It is not an exaggeration to say the PS2 would have sold tens of millions less without this feature. GameCube not having it was absolutely devastating. Nintendo tried to play catch-up with its Panasonic Q model, a version of the GameCube that did include DVD support. However, that model was only ever released in Japan, following very poor sales. Looking back on everything we've learned throughout this video, the mini DVD decision really bothers me. From the very first day GameCube was revealed, Nintendo spent so much time and effort making sure the console would be on par with its competitors on a technical level. They managed to achieve that, and yet were never really able to take full advantage of it because the discs couldn't hold enough space. This frustrated third-party developers who would have to make special accommodations for the GameCube versions of their games. And that's why it's not too surprising that a lot of third parties ditched the console so quickly. With third-party games being worse on GameCube or skipping GameCube entirely, Nintendo found themselves in an all-too-familiar position. Most of the output on GameCube had to come from Nintendo themselves, leading into one of the other major narratives surrounding the console. At the time of its release, GameCube gained a reputation for being very childish. This primarily began due to its unusual design, often jokingly being referred to as a lunchbox. While GameCube's competitors went with slick black colorways featuring futuristic menus and features, the GameCube was a purple cube with a handle on top. I also think the GameCube's resemblance to the Game Boy Advance helped push this narrative. The Game Boy line of consoles was always seen as something for kids, I mean even the name itself implies that. And the Game Boy Advance sported a similar purple color and had a lot of connectivity with the GameCube. I actually think the GameCube's interactivity with the GBA is one of the console's best features, but I can also see how it was harmful in respect to this narrative. However, other than the design itself, I don't totally understand why GameCube got stuck with this reputation. If anything, this was one of the first times that Nintendo actually did embrace mature gaming, making games like Metroid Prime and Eternal Darkness, while partnering with third-party games like Resident Evil 4 and Metal Gear Solid Twin Snakes. I think a lot of it really just was unfair criticism, stemming from the specific time in gaming history that the GameCube was released. I think a lot of people who had grown up with NES, SNES, and N64 were starting to get a bit older and wanted to expand their gaming horizons with different companies. And I do think another reason why the GameCube may have been seen as just for kids was because of some of its missing features, such as multimedia compatibility and online play. We already talked about how important the DVD player was for the PS2, and Microsoft responded by releasing an accessory that would allow the same to be done on Xbox. As we know, Nintendo never released their DVD accessory outside of Japan. I think this led to a perception that the PS2 and Xbox were quote-unquote everyday devices, something that could sit in the living room, while the GameCube GameCube was just the device kids played games on. The lack of online play was another crippling missing feature for GameCube. Online play became big for the first time during this generation with games like SOCOM on PS2 and Halo on Xbox. Sadly, Nintendo once again fell behind the times here, with almost no GameCube games having online capabilities. The only GameCube games released in North America that had online play were the Phantasy Star Online games. The feature wasn't present in any of Nintendo's big multiplayer games like Mario Kart or Melee. Those who had grown up with Nintendo and were now teenagers or adults wanted to play games online with their friends, and Nintendo didn't give them that option. I think looking back on all of this gives a pretty clear picture of why the GameCube struggled the way it did. The console lacked meaningful launch titles, slowing initial momentum. Meanwhile, GameCube's childish perception pushed away many potential customers. And most harmful of all, GameCube was missing important features that gave competitors the upper hand. And yet, despite all of this, GameCube is a console that is remembered incredibly fondly. Many people call it their favorite console, and are even genuinely surprised to hear that it performed so poorly. With that in mind, let's talk about the revisionist history of GameCube now. It's only natural to be a bit biased towards the consoles you grew up with. The nostalgia that comes alongside childhood gaming memories is powerful. And when you're a kid, you have no idea what consoles are selling well or not, you just know it's what you have and you enjoy it. And so that's why I think it goes without saying that of course those who grew up with GameCube love it and share a lot of positive sentiments about it online. But in my eyes, the love for GameCube seems to have far surpassed the 20 million who had it at the time. In fact, the GameCube has aged about as well as any retro console I can think of, and has had its poor reputation totally flipped upside down. I think it all started with the Nintendo Wii, which included GameCube backwards compatibility in its early models. This is how many people, myself included, got to experience GameCube games for the first time. With the Wii being huge and selling like crazy at launch, the GameCube was able to stay relevant simply by being connected to it. I also think the GameCube was able to stay relevant long past its death thanks in large part to the Smash Bros. Community. With Melee being a big competitive game that has been played for years, the GameCube never really left gaming culture, and on multiple occasions, Nintendo has made special accommodations to ensure Smash Bros. Players are able to use GameCube controllers with new entries in the series. They even made a special edition of Smash Bros. For Wii U that featured a GameCube controller and adapter. With the GameCube staying culturally relevant thanks to backwards compatibility and support from the Smash Bros. Community, the console has brought on a whole new group of fans who weren't there when the console was on the market. They weren't there when the console was being outshined by the PS2. They weren't there when the console was being sold for $50 at Walmart because they couldn't get rid of the thing. All they know are the positives, of which there are many, and that's why the conversation has turned so favorable for GameCube. And to be clear, my argument here is not that the GameCube is a bad system undeserving of praise. The point I'm making is that this praise just simply wasn't there at the actual time the console was released. And strangely enough, this can apply to many of the biggest games on the platform as well. There are three games in particular that come to mind for me when we talk about GameCube revisionism. The first is the launch title we briefly mentioned earlier, Luigi's Mansion. I have a whole video on my channel talking about the history of the Luigi's Mansion franchise, so I won't get into it too much here, but the general conclusion you need to know is that the original Luigi's Mansion was kind of seen as a joke at the time. Nintendo fans had been pretty spoiled when it came to launch titles. The NES had Super Mario Bros., the SNES had Super Mario World, and the N64 had Super Mario 64. All three of those games were genre-altering, generation-defining experiences. And then the GameCube got Luigi's Mansion. So while the game is certainly not bad, I can definitely see why fans at the time felt pretty underwhelmed by it. Luigi's Mansion just simply isn't good enough when put through the lens of a major Nintendo launch title. However, those who played it much later grew to love it. They saw the game for what it was, a quirky, fun entry in the Mario universe. This change of opinion eventually led to Luigi's Mansion 2 on 3DS and Luigi's Mansion 3 on Switch. With the franchise now having sold 25 million total copies, the initial fan reception to the original game is a total thing of the past. The next game that got a lot of negative feedback at the time of its launch was the GameCube's 3D Mario game, Super Mario Sunshine. Coming off the heels of Super Mario 64, it was always going to be difficult for whatever next 3D Mario game that had to follow it. And it definitely didn't help that Sunshine is one of the weirder games in the mainline Mario series. Whether it's the voice acting, the setting that includes an entirely new cast of NPCs and enemies, or the flood movement mechanic, Sunshine features a lot of things that are not seen in any other Mario game. Add into that the general jankiness of the game alongside frequent frustrating levels, and fans turned on it pretty quick. It was often labeled the black sheep of the franchise, and many GameCube owners at the time were once again left feeling frustrated. But as the years have gone on, people have become much kinder towards Sunshine. Many of the things that people were mad about at the time now make the game stand out in a series with so many entries. After literal decades of Mario games that can sometimes start to blur together, it's cool to have one that stands so uniquely on its own. I think Mario Sunshine has aged well now that it's been removed from the heavy fan expectations sophistication that comes alongside being that generation's 3D Mario game, similarly to how Luigi's Mansion aged well without the pressure of being a launch title. Fans playing them today are totally removed from the situation they were released into. And there's another game that represents this even better that I haven't mentioned yet, and that game is The Legend of Zelda: The Wind Waker. Wind Waker is my personal favorite Zelda game, I absolutely love it, and that's why I was so surprised to learn that fans at the time were incredibly hard on it. And as it turns out, most of that criticism led all the way back to the Zelda tech demo shown off during GameCube's marketing. I told you that demo would become important later. That Zelda tech demo showed a more realistic style of Zelda that fans fell in love with. The Link and Ganondorf models looked fantastic, and fans spent the next several years dreaming of what a full Zelda game could look like with that graphical style. So when Wind Waker was revealed with its cartoon-style aesthetics, fans felt betrayed. They were furious that they had spent years waiting for a game that seemingly never even existed. It wasn't just because of that tech demo, though. Zelda had become more serious with the N64 installments, and even told a pretty dark story with its most recent mainline entry, Majora's Mask. So for a lot of fans, seeing this more kid-friendly Zelda game hitting the market felt like a step back, regardless of what the tech demo had shown. We know that the GameCube itself was already being heavily criticized for being too childish, and the Wind Waker made this narrative grow even stronger. Fans of the competition used Wind Waker to prove their point that GameCube was just for kids. Meanwhile, Nintendo fans who had been hoping for more mature experiences were frustrated even further. Wind Waker was a classic case of right game, wrong time. If it was released in quite literally any other era of Nintendo's entire history, it would have been universally beloved. Thankfully though, Wind Waker was able to see a renaissance, just like Luigi's Mansion and Mario Sunshine before it. Fans eventually got the darker, more realistic Zelda game they had been hoping for, with Twilight Princess releasing a few years later. This immediately helped stop a lot of the unfair vitriol Wind Waker had received. Then, in 2013, Nintendo released a fantastic HD remake for Wind Waker on the Wii U, which helped address many of the valid issues within the game. All of this led to a total flip of how people view Wind Waker, with many now ranking it among the very best in the series. I tell you these stories of Luigi's Mansion, Sunshine, and Wind Waker to paint the picture that things were not always great for GameCube. Many of the games we consider among the best on the console today were just simply not viewed that way in the moment. There was a lot of frustration among Nintendo's core audience at the time of GameCube, some of it fair, some of it not. But regardless of the validity, it dragged the whole generation down. Many of the biggest criticisms of GameCube or its games were really just signs of the times, and don't affect those of us going back to them now. And so it's no surprise that audiences today view the GameCube so differently than those back then. As I wrap the video up here, I'm left feeling happy for GameCube. I'm happy that this console was given a second chance, and appreciated for all the things it did well. However, I can also totally see why the console struggled at the time, with its missing features and its unconventional lineup of games. And that's why I use the term revisionist history. This kind of revisionism is actually not uncommon in gaming. It feels like every year some new universally hated or beloved game suddenly has the whole conversation change, but this phenomenon seems a bit less common amongst consoles. Whether it was GameCube's unique design, the console's focus on being a games device rather than a multimedia machine, or its specialization in local multiplayer as opposed to online play, all of it are things that we never really saw again from any console. And I think that's a big reason why so many of us have been hit with such heavy nostalgia for it. GameCube is proof of how finicky the console space can be. There's a lot of luck involved, and so many things in and out of your control that can tank a system in the blink of an eye. And that's why it's nice to see a console that was hurt by these things become so beloved today. I hope you enjoyed this retrospective on GameCube. If you did, please leave a like and subscribe, it helps out the channel a ton. And if you made it this far, I would love to hear about your experience with GameCube in the comments below.